Hello, welcome back to Tay Talks. Today's episode was super fun to film. Sanu is one of my colleagues in the neuroendocrine space. I remember the first paper that I worked on with him. My boss, mentor, friend, John, had been so impressed with the speed at which Nanu turned that paper around. He didn't even bother to try to say that I would compete with that level of speed. He is one of the most efficient and eloquent people that I've met. Nanu has navigated the academic clinical path and then transitioned into big pharma and now into the biotech space. When I entered the academic space, it was very much advertised to me as us versus them in terms of pharma companies and the academia hospital side. And I, from day one, felt like that was a problem because I felt like a good clinician would make an excellent person on the pharmaceutical side, because that perspective is so necessary to make sure that we're not having issues when we do open up a clinical trial. And I think that truly embodies what healthcare is that we're all working together and fulfilling different roles for the same purpose. And that purpose is moving the needle forward, helping patients achieve whatever their goals are, and making sure that we're putting out really the best possible science and medicine and healing into the world. And yeah, I just hope you guys enjoy. You feel like extends into every decision that you make, whether personal, professional, and no matter what the pressure, financial, corporate.
Yeah.
You know, but what's that grounding thing for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's human dignity. We didn't touch on explicitly in the decision to pivot from academia to industry. It was also a lifestyle thing. I didn't realize it, but at the time, until much later, it was just that I was giving everybody my best, except my family. And by the end of the day, you're spent. You're giving everything you have, but you have to nurture those relationships too. For example, if a treatment, you know, increasing or decreasing your time to progression by 5 months. Yet, you know, 3 of those 5 months, you're spending 75% of time in a hospital facility. Is that actually 5 months? Is that actually
right.
2 months?
Right.
Right. So I think when we're really looking at value of our treatments, I think time toxicity is something that, you know, I think we need to think more about, because it is valuable.
Who am I calling when I need to add this blood draw on, or when I need to go get this biopsy scheduled faster, or, you know, the radiologist hasn't read a scan. Okay, where am I going to get this emergency read? Like, very simple things that you would think are, you know, it's okay to knock on doors. Okay, so what's one thing that's on your bucket list that nobody would, like, guess?
Oh, great question. I want to do a TED Talk, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah, I did a lot of spoken word actually in college and kind of storytelling.
Yeah.
And still kind of determining the content of it. I think, you know, certainly it would be perhaps maybe oncology focused, or at least some of my patient experience focused.
Okay.
But I'd love to do a TED Talk.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Have you thought about setting up like a TEDx in your area if there isn't one?
Yeah, there's a few that are in the area, so at least trying to tag on to be part of it, to start there. But yeah, in Nashville, I actually used to do some storytelling. There's like a little group called 10 by 9. It was fascinating. Yeah.
You have the voice for it and you have the presence for it. So I can totally see that. I never would have guessed it, but I can see it now
it's
that you say it.
And maybe I'm a good, pardon my language, I'm a good bullshitter, I guess. So maybe
that's
also a good criteria as well.
It's never been the impression I got from you. If you are, is that something you're good at?
Maybe I'm okay on my feet. You know, you learn over time, right? And I think you got to adjust. So
yeah. Did you always know you were going to go into medicine?
No, actually I did not. I've sort of always had this tension between the arts and the sciences. I think for a long time I wanted to do maybe writing or law school. I actually did a lot of debate coming up in high school and so forth. My grandfather actually was a novelist as well. And so that kind of storytelling theme runs deep. And so it wasn't actually until, must have been just end of sophomore year in college, I actually ended up getting into a lab at UCSF where they were doing a PI there named Neil Shah. He was working on actually the first generation of overcoming resistance to Gleevec. At that time, there was no post-Gleevec drugs.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty amazing because he had a phase 1 clinic and lab. And so he was actually developing and compounds that he then actually was taking to the clinic. And somehow there, that light bulb sort of clicked that I was like, wow, this is something that I could definitely maybe see myself getting into.
So what were you majoring in?
So I did both. I did cell biology, but I also did philosophy.
Okay.
So it's kind of hedging my bets a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you ever wish that you had gone the other route, or are you happy where you ended up?
You know, I think I'm actually really grateful because I think this path opens up actually many of the other doors. I think you can be a writer, you can do all those things through the lens of medicine. I think sometimes it can be harder to be a researcher or certainly obviously a physician without that training. So I'm really grateful I did it maybe this way.
So obviously oncology, I guess, started early for you in college. Did you know right away, okay, I'm going to stay in oncology for the rest of my career at that point?
Yeah. And, you know, I think cancer, like for so many of us, touches many in our family. And so I had a grandfather, my mom's side was MDS. He was a novelist. So actually have a lot of distinct memories growing up of, like, at that time for MDS, there actually weren't many treatments. So he was just getting transfusions. And I remember actually, even as a kid, like seeing just the veins from the constant transfusions and saying, it looked like a map to me. I actually remember this. And I'd always say, I want to come up with a medicine that kind of takes away the map, you know, because it was associated with some discomfort. And then my paternal grandfather actually had pancreatic cancer. I had never met him. So there's always kind of this thread of, like, maybe if I do go into medicine, cancer is something that I wanted to focus on.
And phase one, I guess the love for phase one also started early, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, drug hunting, I always was fascinated by the fact that every drug that is in our cabinets today, right, started as a phase one drug. So I always was fascinated by, like, signal seeking. How do you kind of see the signal from the noise? And so phase one started early for me, that itch as well.
What's your favorite thing about phase one oncology now, not just from a lab, but from a clinical perspective, having done both sides?
Yeah, I think what I love about phase one is inherently the patients that you enroll, which is those that otherwise don't have any other hope, right? It's many folks that have exhausted other options. And so you really see some of those profound effects. And what I also like is that you can, even one patient's response or anecdotal story is enough to flip the script. So I always think about the story of, you know, pembrolizumab, right? And initially tested in a bunch of microsatellite stable, immune unresponsive tumors. And there was one patient out of the 20 that had a complete response. And the folks at Hopkins were like, maybe we should check because as a young patient, maybe there's a hereditary story. And lo and behold, it turns out, you know, they had a germline Lynch mutation, and that kind of opened up that story there. So I love the fact that individual patients can have a disproportionate impact in phase one. But I also enjoy now that phase one is kind of becoming the new phase two, and that we're not just looking for safety anymore. We're actually trying to look for signals even in earlier settings.
Did you feel restricted at all when you were in the clinic? And now do you feel like a different sense? At what point did you decide, okay, clinic is not for me and I want to go to the pharmaceutical side? And I guess a follow-up to that is also, do you plan on staying in that path? Yeah. Or is it kind of one of those, I just want this experience to come back on the flip side?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. Yeah, Tamia, that was one of the toughest decisions I made was to leave. And honestly, it was because of leaving my patients, right? And so you form these relationships and then essentially I was bidding goodbye for 3 months, right? And so that was the toughest part. But I knew it was the right decision because ultimately in the clinic, I was always confronted by the fact that I only had limited arrows in the quiver. So ultimately, no matter what, I think for me, the most heartbreaking part of oncology, and that's why I certainly tip my hat to all the colleagues who are still in that, is that there comes that day where you always have to break bad news to even, with barring exception, right? I think we're not quite at that point where we have that. And so I was always confronted by the fact that I wish we had more options. And so to truly make a ripple on working on actually adding arrows to the quiver, you know, I quickly began to realize that at least the way drug development has now pivoted, it's so industry facing that I needed to be on that side. And so, you know, I'll never say never. I'm very happy on this side. In many ways, I think that I'm actually doing the purest science that I've done in many years, because here, you know, we have the resources, we have the drugs, and now we're just signal seeking, right? I'm not worrying about resource limitations, grants, institutional overhead. I'm just doing actually signal seeking, right? And it's interesting is that I think about patients daily. We're navigating side effects. We're navigating dosing. So I'm thinking actually as much about patients as I did, just minus not seeing them. And so for me, I think I've found other ways now to scratch that itch. Obviously, cancer sadly touches still all of us. So I still do many second opinions, either for family, friends, or colleagues. I found a few platforms like My Cancer Expert Now, where I still do some second opinions for GI or neuroendocrine cancer. But I am grateful for being a step removed, where I can just focus on the science without a bit of the day-to-day, just the grind.
What was a misconception you had before going into pharma that has now been squashed?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. Maybe a month ago, I've been trying to sort of serve as a little bit of a guide now to sort of shed light on this side of the aisle, because I think it is such a black box, right? I think the truth is that, you know, pharma is such a heterogeneous experience. It depends so much on where you go. So for example, I did a little bit of large biopharma initially, and that is very different, right? That is much more regimented. There's a huge commercial drive there. Maybe perhaps the more classical pharma that people think about.
Yeah.
Biotech is so different. So I think maybe some of the myths to quell are that you're only looking at commercial scenarios in pharma. You know, you're not doing actually true design or drug development. Actually, in fact, you know, all the trials and so forth, everything's being written on the sponsor side of things. And so I think the thoughtfulness of sponsors in thinking about trial design in some ways is as rigorous, if not more so, than what we tend to think on the other side of the aisle. So I think the science-driven nature of it has really been eye-opening. And I think one of the things I've loved, and I'm sure you've encountered this too, is that pharma is far more democratic. So, you know, even though I was fairly junior, I was fortunate that I had kind of created a reputation in academia. So you're almost at that point where what you say goes, right? It's kind of, even though there's thought behind it, medicine is still eminence-based, you know, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. But what I loved about pharma is you make your point and you can be the physician in the room. And your CEO or your CSO could be basically someone with an MBA or a bachelor's, but prove it, right? So they could have far more insight than you on a topic. And so what I love is that decisions that are made in pharma are truly multidimensional, and you have to prove your points. There's not an inherent, obviously there's inherent valuing of positions, but I think there's a lot more of actually having to prove your point rather than just accepting things a priori.
I like that a lot. I think on the outside looking in, that's not something that you think of, and it's not something that you consider when you're thinking about that switch. I think the triggers for the switch are usually different than more freedom in terms of thought, right? It's that's not usually, I think that is a misconception that probably a lot of people still have on the academia side. I think something that I love and that I'm hearing through what you're saying is it's not an us versus them kind of thing. It's a we're all in this for the same reasons. There's just different sides to it. And I think that's something that I try to emphasize even within an institution, right? That it's not the nurses and the doctors and the coordinators in this, it's everybody and the patient. Like it's a circle. Patients in the middle, we all have a role, but nobody is above another. And so it sounds like in pharma, you're experiencing that same thing, if not more than on the...
Very much so. And I think when you start to look back, right, like macro, when I think about a progression in medicine, right, and you're going to see this, right, as a medical student, you take care of initially starting for a single patient, right? And then as you get more seasoned, you take care of a few patients. Then you become a resident, you're managing a team. Then you become an attending, you're responsible for the entire team or the patients on your list, and then your clinic. Then you become the head of your program, and then it's all of those patients. Then you take a macro step level in perhaps in pharma, and now you're working on the drugs for those patients, right? And then even there's a step above, right, which is venture, right? So where you're actually dictating where resource funding is going. So I love that there's this macro kind of element, but we're absolutely all on the same team. If we win, the investigators win and the patients win. And ultimately, it's the patient win that matters. So I think one of the things that's really cool is that when you're chasing a target, particularly in drug development, that's hot. You know, I think it's inherent, right? You always have a competitive landscape kind of intelligence. You're always aware of sort of your competitor colleagues, but you're actually all working on the same team. And we were just talking about this the other day. It's like, this is great. If any of these drugs hit, who's going to win? Patients are going to win, right? So we're all actually rooting for the same thing. It's just looking at it through different lenses.
Yeah. Did you feel a huge shift when you went from a large pharma company to the smaller biotechs? And what would you say are like pros and cons of each?
Yeah, definitely. You know, for me, I felt that I think large biopharma, there's just a much greater concentration of expertise. And so, for example, let's say a medical director position, which is oftentimes the starting level position for academics who transition. At a big pharma, there may be 100 such people, whereas in a biotech, there may be 3 or 4. And so in large pharma, you're a little bit more siloed based upon your molecule, because each molecule is such a dynamic profile. And oftentimes, for example, with a large biopharma, you can have a molecule. Let's say you have 5 different molecules, you know, 3 or 4 in phase 3, maybe 1 or 2 are in earlier phases. Those are very distinct. Just because of the scale of the operations, you end up being siloed a little bit within a molecule and then sometimes even within a phase. And so I think large biopharma is fantastic for folks that like a little bit more regimented views of what they're going to be doing on a day-to-day. The late phase, you're kind of working with your statisticians, you're really working on recruitment, and then you're looking at your outcomes. Early phase, you're doing more design and perhaps a little bit more of the biomarker and signal seeking. But biotech is a blend of the two. As a biotech company, for example, I can speak for my own case, we have 3 clinical assets. So I'm involved in all of them at all of their different iterations. And so one day you could be working on a preclinical meeting for one of your molecules. The next day you're doing a phase 2 readout for a cohort. So biotech is just inherently a little bit more dynamic. That's not to say good or bad. It's just the experience is more diverse. So for me, I realized that being creative was a very important thing for me. And of course, just because you've proven yourself in one phase, you still have to prove yourself in the other. And I found that in biotech, I would have an earlier opportunity to truly impact strategy, creative thinking, and dynamism more so than in large biopharma. And that was kind of the reason for me ending up in biotech.
I love that. I love that. What do you feel like is a mistake that you've made along the way that like really taught you something and that you think about often?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I always hesitate to call even missteps mistakes, because I think that like sometimes you have to be lost to find yourself, right? And so I think one of the things, honestly speaking, is it took me like 1.5 years, honestly, just to transition to industry. I think perhaps one of the missteps initially was I was kind of trying to bridge both worlds. Like I had left academia, I'd left Vanderbilt, but I still felt sort of like that I was in this middle ground. And not to say that I wasn't enjoying myself, but I don't think I appreciated much of the opportunity initially in biotech, because I was still sort of yearning for what I was apparently missing, which was the patient care, some of the colleagues that I had, you know, nurtured relationships with. But I think with pivots, you have to recognize that many doors open just as some doors close. So I think maybe the misstep I would say is I wasn't as appreciative of the now, but I think now, you know, 2.5, almost 3 years in, I've really sort of embraced both my past, but also my present. And I think I see a lot more alignment in those elements, so I'm able to enjoy that more. So I would say that's one of the things. But I can't think of anything overtly that I would say that I would really regret doing.
Okay. Not just in this stage of life, in any other stage of life that you can think of.
Yeah, great point.
Like a good pivot.
Great pivot. I mean, I think obviously I've been very lucky to encounter, I would say, many remarkable people in my life. Maybe some missteps for me are that I know, like, it's funny, my wife gets on me on this all the time, and so do my parents, and rightfully so, but just staying in touch with people, right? There are truly some people that, like, move you, right? And you really connect with on a deep level. And it was surreal. I was connecting with an old roommate of mine from college, and I talked to him after, like, 12 years. And we just picked up like right where we left off. But again, there shouldn't be that gap. So I think some of the missteps I would say in this journey of sometimes striving is I felt, and I don't know if it's a misstep. You know, when I think about a lot of people who've achieved in life, there's sacrifice, right? There is implicit sacrifice. on some levels, you have to simplify your life. But I think there have been relationships that, you know, I'm aware of that I still want to nurture. And I could have done a better job, but I think there's still time to
fix
get
it.
Back to some of those things.
Yeah. What's your routine like day to day? And where do you see opportunities for like change in your routine or that you would like to implement?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things too, and that was sort of implicit, we didn't touch on explicitly in the decision to pivot from academia to industry, was also a lifestyle thing. I didn't realize it, but at the time until much later, it was just that I was giving everybody my best, except my family. And by the end of the day, you're spent. You're giving everything you have. But you have to nurture those relationships too. And so one of the big reasons for my wife and I was just to, you only live this life once or so that we know of, right? And so you also have to enjoy the time that we're given because nothing is granted, right? I think if cancer teaches us anything, life is so fragile and we actually don't know how much we have left at any given point. And so I think it's just being comfortable that we've spent the time in the way we want to spend it and have some control over our narrative. And so what I love now is that even though I'm working hard, I mean, I think I'm wired, right? You could put me on an island. I'm still going to have to read because I think I love to learn. I'm curious. That's not going to stop. But I'm coloring between the lines. And so what I mean by that is we actually go into the office now all 5 days, which I love actually because it's a small office setting. There's so much cross-pollination and you don't have to do a meeting. You just pop in next door something. But yeah, it's very much like a, you know, 7 to 4, 7 to 5. And then I do my work between that period and then I'm done. You know, the weekends are time for me to be creative, maybe do some deep thinking if there's something work related, but really just to have that time. And I think in my past life, those lines were completely blurred, right? I would be doing my trial work on the weekends. I'd be writing my grants on the weekends. And then, you know, the patient element, there's no end, right? I mean, obviously.
Right. Yeah. You can't turn that off.
You can't turn that off. And so I was finding that I was running out of hours in the day, but now, at least with my routine, I feel like I have time for most things. So just time to, you know, on weekends to do the things we love, right? Whether it's going, taking a drive out, we're really fortunate. You just cross the street, we're at the water right here. And so
that's beautiful.
The things that really, I think, complete you more than just a work identity, starting to tap into those things sort of again, honestly, after probably, you know, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. Did you ever take any gap years in your education?
I did actually. So I had, I deferred. So right after college, I was up at Berkeley. I deferred for a year of medical school before starting in Atlanta at Emory. I just wanted to do something different. And so I actually taught in East Oakland for a year. So it was amazing. Just did kind of math and science to junior high and high school.
I love that.
So it was awesome. And then got to spend some time at home as well. Got to read. It was honestly like a year of just getting to spend time with loved ones and reading. And mm-hmm. It was the best decision I've made. Because when I came to medical school, I was just so energized. And I kind of felt that I was recharged. And, you know, because it is a grind, right? There's
Of course.
But I think if you have that appreciation of why you're doing it, it just gives you a different bent on it.
What's your favorite genre to read?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Man, I would say I kind of bounce between fiction and nonfiction.
Yeah.
I would say in nonfiction, you know, I'm a big like kind of behavioral economics guy. So like why people make the decisions they do really fascinates me. So like Malcolm Gladwell, Chip and Dan Heath, one of my favorite books is called Made to Stick, How to Make Ideas Sticky, right? And what is it about a story that sticks? So those types of like kind of anthro-sociological behavior in nonfiction is awesome. And then I love like mystery and crime as well. So that also extends to like nonfiction. So like, mm-hmm. Let's say there's a guy whose books I love. His name's Patrick Radin O'Keefe. He wrote like the Empire of Pain book about the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
And then, like Michael Connelly in fiction, who wrote a lot of like the detective stuff, like Bosch, Don Winslow is one of my favorites. So it combines a little bit of myth, crime, those types of elements.
What's the most recent book you read?
Let's see. So yeah, I read a book called City in Ruins by Don Winslow. And it was third of a trilogy. It's kind of like a rethinking of the Iliad. which is pretty cool. But it was as opposed to Greeks and Trojans, it's the Italian and Irish mob, and kind of a trilogy fun. That way. So really like fascinating and well done. Highly recommend it.
Okay. Are you a Kindle or a hardcover or softcover?
I'm a hardcover guy. I'm going to be buying books till hopefully they never go out of extinction. But
yeah. Have you tried the Kindle or no?
You know, my wife does it. I got to turn the page. I got to feel it. You know, I got to smell it.
Yeah. Are you anti dog earing or are you bookmark only?
Bookmark only. I think, you know, I try to, I'm a pretty purist when it comes to the integrity of books. It's good size. I would say it's probably in our living room. It's like, that's like the art we have is like three shelves full. I've been probably dragging along this collection for the last 10 years. It's only growing. So
very nice. I love that. Right now I'm very much a hardcover book lover as well. But what I'm doing right now is because I'm all over the place. And I'm moving and it's just been crazy.
Right,
So I switched to Kindle for now, but then I buy the book after I'm done. If I like
perfect.
It. And I keep it. And I'm like, then once I'm settled, I'll have the library ready to go.
So will you be keeping some stuff in storage? And
I am, in Tampa. And then, you know, at my parents as well. So they're here, you know, I'll be back and forth here. So they're here in Tampa as well. So,
oh, cool. I didn't realize that. That's great.
Yeah. You know, things work out the way they work out. So I just this for the rest of the year. It's been nice to be able to, you know, all be together, especially because now I'm going to be moving and you're only going to see each other every so often. So
absolutely.
It's been a lot of nice quality time.
We take those things for granted, you know, how many opportunities you get to really spend that time. And I always think about that time is probably the most valuable currency, right? And
it really is.
And I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel like at a certain age, like you feel as though time stops for everyone else. And like, oh, you're growing, but your parents aren't aging or right? And so I think that's awesome that you've been able
to
take advantage of that.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's something that you see a lot, right, in terms of treatment for patients, in terms of your life, that reflection that I think when I started working in oncology, I don't know what it was like for you when you started seeing patients of your own in clinic. Mm-hmm. For me, people around me thought I would get depressed, right? You're treating these patients all the time and things like that. I found it to be the opposite. I found it that you form those relationships with patients and you do go through those lows when you lose a few, and they do come in threes. I don't know if you've noticed that, but they always do.
They do.
But I found an appreciation for life and for really like all the small things just went away almost immediately, and really like valuing relationships and time and everything, just seeing the good in every single day became a huge highlight. Did you ever go through a depressive period with it, or was it the same for you?
I think, you know, it's, and I don't know if it's a little bit different, because I think you'll see too, like, obviously, even though you probably spent more time at the patients than even PIs, because you're seeing them in and out, I think it's still a little different when they're your patients, right, in terms of the burden of loss. So I think what I felt was I always felt energized after seeing patients, but what I would feel is that at times that I would feel sad out of the blue. And it's because I realized that I hadn't had an opportunity to mourn, right? I'd lost four or five people that I was very close with. And then it just hits you that, wow, you just have to keep it moving, right? And so I think there is something to say that you have to give up something to gain something. And I always feel like, particularly in oncology, you have to give up a little bit of your humanity in order to serve, because you just can't take each hit in the way a normal person would.
Right.
But I think it was very much humbling to recognize that every word that you spoke in that room was a dinner table conversation. That's the conversation that this individual is having with their loved ones at the dinner table. So that ripple effect is incredible. And I think you really value, you know, what you're alluding to as well, time. And I think, to be fair, we probably don't do as good of a metric or assessment of looking at time toxicity, right? And I think maybe that is something from a sponsor perspective, as well as investigator perspective, we should think about, right? I think, for example, if a treatment, you know, increasing or decreasing your time to progression by 5 months, yet, you know, 3 of those 5 months, you're spending 75% of time in a hospital facility, is that actually 5 months? Is that actually
right.
2 months?
Right. Right.
So I think when we're really looking at value of our treatments, I think time toxicity is something that, you know, I think we need to think more about because it is valuable.
It absolutely is. And there's a company right now that I've been contracting, consulting with for almost a year now. And their whole platform is to basically create metrics. So they pull metrics from studies in terms of time, cost, and burden on both the patient, the provider, the coordinator, the site, and the sponsor. And it creates kind of a dashboard for you to be able to compare, how does my protocol compare to, you know, the industry standard or, you know, a competitor protocol or anything like that in order to optimize that. And it goes down to like volume of blood that we're collecting on each patient. And, you know, the goal with this is to eventually optimize the creation of protocols for both the pharma and the site side. So that's been a cool perspective. You don't see a lot of biotech companies thinking about that in a,
that's awesome.
You know, very active manner. So that's been really cool to work with.
That's amazing. I'm so like, you know, and that's what you realize, right? Like drug development is not just developing drugs. It's about optimizing the development process too. And so I love that you've gotten insight on that because then, you know, these are things that are going to resonate with you, right? Like in a few years when you're writing these protocols, you remember that, hey, is this actually, is, you know, my day 15, 6 hour PK actually needed? Or can I just get by with, you know, next week when the patient comes in, right? So absolutely. I think we all need to do a better job of paring these things down to look at the absolute necessities. What's absolutely essential? But agree, right? I think there are some things that, hey, maybe we actually need to be more rigorous, right? Like maybe the first few days of dosing, we really do need patients on a more intensive, you know, immunotherapeutic to be in the hospital setting. And that's okay as well, if we can save things down the road.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you, who was the first person that you talked to about transitioning to the pharma space? And who was the first person you called when you made that decision?
Oh, wow. That's a great, great question. So I actually, the first person I talked to when I was thinking about it was one of my former mentors at Vanderbilt, Leora Horn. She had transitioned actually to AstraZeneca. And, you know, she was a prolific investigator, mostly small cell, but all lung cancer as well. And I actually initially had gone to fellowship at Vanderbilt because I had interviewed with her and I had done lung cancer work before I switched to GI. And so I picked her brain really with the large part being, is it too early to come over? Because I've done 4 years on faculty, but some, you know, they're differing opinions, but I think her perspective was just that, no, come early, learn, and then you can grow as well. There's not an arbitrary, you know, 10-year threshold. You have to stay at a particular level before coming. So that was very, very impactful for me. And then the first person I told was my mentor at Vanderbilt, Jordan Berlin, and one of the toughest, you know, kind of toughest conversations, right?
Yeah.
But I think like many great mentors and people that truly are well-wishers, they make it easier for you. And I think there was a recognition that I was looking for something more. And sometimes in academia, you do give up breadth for depth. And so the academic model is to really hone specialists. And I think sometimes when you think about in a siloed perspective and you're more of a cross-dynamic thinker, it can be a little bit limiting. And so I saw the writing sort of for me on the wall was that I wanted the model in which I was going into was diving deeper, but giving up kind of some of that breath. And that's ultimately what prompted it. So yeah, so he was the first person I told after making the decision.
Yeah. How do you identify a good mentor for you? And do you feel like the mentors you've had in prior stages of your career are still mentors, but in a different capacity? Or do you feel like you kind of graduate them to just colleagues or...
Yeah, it's an awesome question, actually. And I think there's so few truly good mentors out there. And it's not because people don't have the capacity to. I think it's just in the way the world is wired to actually make time to listen and to actually see where somebody wants to go and how to facilitate that, not just imparting your lens into their vision. Just because someone might be has multiple strengths, you know, you think they should go there, but it's actually listening to what someone wants. So I think it's hard to find those people. You know, I think for me, it's sort of been interesting because many of my mentors previously were in academia. And so as I've pivoted to kind of a completely new environment, I've had to remake, you know, my set of mentors. I think those folks will always remain colleagues, friends, even pseudo family on some levels. But I think the mentorship had to change because I was doing something that was different. Even, you know, it's interesting. You're mentioning kind of some of the old school ways of thinking. Whether we want to acknowledge or not, when you make that transition, it does change the dynamics and it does change relationships, right? Because, you know, first of all, you've left a place. Second of all, you've gone to, you know, I wouldn't say the dark side, but the road not taken, right? So it does change relationships. But I think the true relationships do persist. But I've found in my experience that I've been able to pivot and then look for real mentors on the industry side of things, many of whom were former academics who transitioned, so have that life as well. But also folks that just here are in leadership positions that have experienced industry, because I felt that I've needed a different type of mentorship in this phase of life.
What do you feel like is the ideal mentee-mentor dynamic? I think that's hard for, you know, we hear it all the time, right? And students will hear that and they say, okay, identify a mentor and you need multiple mentors in different parts and not one person's going to fit all those buckets. But what do you have to do to be a good mentee and receive, right, what you need from the mentor and also give your part? And in terms of like structure for that relationship, do you feel like you always define it and you have that very overt conversation? Like, I'm identifying you as a mentor. Can you take me on? Can we set up this kind of schedule, these checkpoints? Or is it just organic and, you know, you pick their brains whenever you need it?
Yeah, I think that's a phenomenal question. I think being both a mentee and a mentor, I think there's a few things that are absolutely needed. And the first thing is actually just initiative, right? I think as a mentor, I was able to recognize that for my fellows and others that initiative is the most important thing. Curiosity is the trait, right? Are you curious? Do you love to learn? And are you teachable, right? And do you have openness in your thought? And I think if you can reflect that and you're surrounded by great people, oftentimes in many environments, and I was going to ask you the same because you've obviously had some amazing mentors, and particularly John is one of the ones that I'm thinking of, maybe for both of us actually as well. But I think that openness and initiative, I think, are the two key traits that I've seen in order to be mentored, because I've found from my own time as a mentee or when I was reaching out to people, those were the traits that were the most easily identifiable by people that ultimately mentored me. I think those were the things that they said that drew us together. I also think, though, beyond kind of the formal structure, there has to be an ease, right? There has to be a fundamental understanding of just, it doesn't have to be shared views, but I think it has to be just an ease of how to approach a question, right? And the need to ask questions. And I think if you can establish that, the rest of those prescriptions sort of fall into line. I think initially it is important. And oftentimes what can be challenging, even at the fellowship level, right, is that the people that are sometimes desired mentors are oftentimes the busiest people. So how do you find time? How do you make time? But I also think that it's a two-way street, because I think people who are in positions of elevation have gotten there because of great mentors. And the best mentors that I've had, they all recognize how lucky they've been to have been mentored to be in that position. So they give back. I think one of the tenets of the Hippocratic Oath is to teach. You have to teach. You're mandated to teach those that are worthy and ask for it, right? So it's almost like I always felt when I was in a position of being a mentor, I could never say no. When someone genuinely, earnestly reached out to me, I had to make time. And still today, I feel that way. So I think that's the key, finding those folks that are driven and drawn for the right reasons. And I think have an openness of thought and a freedom of allowing you to find your own way. Those, at least from my perspective, are the fundamental ingredients of that relationship. But curious, what would you say?
I completely agree with you. The initiative is a big part. And I think the other thing, and I think you're right, it depends on who's your mentor and what stage they're at in their career and their life. For me, as a mentee, I found that I have to be the one to reach out. I have to be the one to kind of own the majority of the relationship and own the majority of the work as well, and know, kind of learn to read my mentor in terms of what their strengths and weaknesses are, right? So are they a good communicator? Yes or no? Are they organized or not? What makes them tick to be able to give me the best of them, right? So I think that it's a lot of reading people and like more emotional intelligence than it is actual work in terms of the relationship. And then identifying for myself what I need out of this, right? So I would say, like, taking John, for example, and my relationship with him, the way I approached that was after a few months of working together, I realized, okay, this man knows this stuff. I like this disease and I want to explore more of this, but I am not at a point in my career right now where I can say, hey, I want to do this project, right? So I approached him, I said, I need a project and I want to help. Let me know what you have going on. And so he gave me an assignment. I asked for, you know, what are you looking for in terms of output? I didn't ask for any guidance on the project itself. And then I took it the way that I thought he wanted to see it. And for me, that was the best way to learn, right? Is show him what I'm understanding from him first and then see, is that what he was expecting or not? And if not, okay, why? And what, like, teach me now. So that's kind of how I've approached every project since then and every, you know, endeavor with him and with others. Tell me if I'm meeting what's in your head. And if it's not, why is it not? And then we can have a conversation. And obviously, as you become more senior, that relationship changes, the conversation changes, and then it kind of even flips in certain cases, right? You end up teaching some things and they end up teaching you some things. When I'm mentoring somebody, I am looking for that. I don't know if it's tenacity, drive. I don't need you to know everything. I don't need you to know anything. I just need to see that you actually want to get to that position and that you're not afraid to mess up along the way, but then fix it, right? Not make the same mistake 10 times.
Exactly.
Out of carelessness or, you know, just oops, you know, oopsie, I forgot kind of thing. It's like, why? Are you in it or not? And so that
exactly.
That's kind of,
I think that teachability piece, right? That, as you said, are you a little smarter today than you were yesterday, right? Something we talked about, are you incorporating that? I think those grips are so important, benchmarks to really see is someone investing, right? Because you're making a commitment, right, as a mentor and someone. And so you want to see that commitment being reciprocated. And, you know, some of the best advice I got in fellowship, actually, so I was a first-year fellow, our chief fellow at the time, he said, you have to be your own CEO, right? He said, ultimately, you want to make it in academia, these folks are already made. They could, and I'm not saying this in a callous way, but they don't care whether you make it or not. There's another crop coming in next year, right? So you have to be your biggest advocate. You have to care the most about your own projects, because if you don't, no one else is, right? And I think that is the piece that you were talking about, the fact that you are already coming in, right? You got some outlines from John and then you interpreted that and you brought it to him. And it doesn't matter if it's wrong or right, but the initiative and ability to kind of put that on the table, I think shows a lot of those skill sets. I think the appetite to make mistakes too is something over time that I have come to appreciate as a very, very important trait. I don't know if you've noticed this working with younger people, younger trainees as well in medicine. I feel like one of the downsides of there is perfectionistic traits, right? And I think, I mean, there's always been that, right, in medicine, because you draw the people that are the brightest, people that are wired in a certain type of way. And that's great, right? Because you want people to be detail oriented, take things personally. Because when you're taking care of human beings, you want those traits in a provider. But the downside of that is the lack of appetite to go out on a limb, to actually propose something, to make a mistake. And I think one of the things that would always draw me to people is that I would say, you know, don't be afraid to make mistakes. I'd always tell my med students, this is the time, propose something. It's okay. You have backup. Now what you're actually proposing isn't going to have an impact on the patient, but make your mistakes now. Don't be afraid to go out on a limb, stand on your position and think about why you're making certain recommendations or proposals that you are. And I think that I've found, and now as I'm looking back at my own career and others that have been very, very successful in different walks of life, it's that appetite for not being afraid to make mistakes. That's a pretty common thread that I've started to see.
I agree 100%. It's that we don't need to follow, you know, SOPs and protocols and all of that are in place as a guidance in general, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a CYA. It's there in case somebody brand new is walking in. Zero idea. But you're right, that ability to confidently make a mistake and know when to make a mistake, right? And when I can take that risk, not being spoon-fed everything, right? Because I think that process of even at like the most basic level of like, figure out how the hospital is structured, right? Where are you going? Who am I calling when I need to add this blood draw on, or when I need to go get this biopsy scheduled faster, or you know, the radiologist hasn't read a scan. Okay, where am I going to get this emergency read? Like, very simple things that you would think are, you know, it's okay to knock on doors. It's okay to walk into the wrong room. It's okay to, you know, pick up the phone and just call somebody and say, hey, I don't know, but help me out. I made one of the biggest mistakes, if you will, when I started, in my mentor at the time on a coordinating level, I was in phase one, and she just kind of assigned everything to me and, like, hands off, was like, figure it out. So I had scheduled this protocol required biopsies before treatment. Nowhere did it say that the lab couldn't receive samples on a Saturday. So biopsies were scheduled on a Friday. Two patients are on the table, came from Georgia, both of them at the time. And the lab calls me and they're like, we can't collect these samples. I'm like, what is that supposed to mean? I'm like, well, the patient's on the table. So we're, we are collecting the sample. Now you're going to need to tell me what to do with it. And they're like, no, no, like, absolutely not. So I was like, okay, executive decision. I'm not doing this. So I told IR with nothing behind me. I said, draw the samples. We got this. You know, we're going to take care of this. Send the patients home, do what you need to do, and continue as planned. Of course, I'm getting called from, like, directors, like, you can't do that. That's not your call to make, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, there's a patient on the table. I'm not telling them we're taking the needle out and we're going to bring you back next week.
We can't. Yeah, exactly.
It's not happening. Even if they were from down the road, they're on the table. Like, we're not, this is not happening. So ended up, I mean, I was on the phone with directors at Merck. I was on the phone with labs across the state, found a different lab that was open on a Saturday, came back like 3 hours later after calling everybody and their mother. That, you know, Merck had called my manager and was like, who is this person? You know, not in a negative way, but in
how
did she even get our number? And they were like, okay, impressive, because we got it taken care of, but just wanted to let you know that she has been, you know, fighting for the patient all day.
Amazing.
And, you know, and so it was a chaotic day, exhausting day. You're knocking on, I was there for 2 weeks. This was 2 weeks into a new position, new place, all of that. But I tell that to people that I'm mentoring, not in a, you know, pat on my back, in a, like, I was, you know, nothing inside of me was happy that day. I was stressed, but something had to get done, you know? And so that's where it's like, okay, I messed up. I shouldn't have scheduled it on a Friday. Okay, now I'll deal with the why and the how we're going to fix it on Monday. You know, right now, let's just get the sample where it needs to go. And
that
it happened.
Learning that,
so,
that learning that you got, right? That learning that's on the other side of the discomfort. I think that's the thing. It's always interesting that you mentioned this, because I always told mentees, like, actually the last phase of a project is the hardest. So actually, when you hit the resistance, don't stop, keep pushing, because it's actually going to give right there. You're almost there. So it's almost that sign. You need to hit that resistance and create the friction to sort of this environment. But no, absolutely. Just also just questioning why.
Yeah.
You know, it's surprising, but I've been in multiple pharma boardrooms where, you know, things are sort of, it seems as though things have been thought about or set in stone, and you're just like, why is this happening? And all of a sudden people pivot and like, wait, oh, wait, we don't, why?
Yeah.
Why was this? And you find the origin and you make it so that, so you can always contribute something, right?
Yeah.
And it never hurts to ask why. Obviously, all of us, you know, we're respectful. We do it in a respectful way. We're trying to win as a program, for the patient or for the program. But you don't ever be afraid to ask why, because there are certain things that may have just been done a certain way, but you're also bringing something to the table. So I think that going out on a little bit of a limb encourages those things, which still today, I would say, for certainly both of us.
Do you know why, or do you have an idea of why there's been such a shift in culture in just the past, I would say, like, 5 or 6 years? Because everybody that is new into, it's not an age thing. It's a, like, new into a workplace or new into a workforce or, you know, anything at all. I feel like there's this hesitance to even work for, like, a minute outside of whatever is prescribed, right? Or, and not just in time, in thinking, in everything is not my job, and then, like, leave it alone, or like you said, that fear of making a mistake.
Yeah, it's a fantastic question, right? It's always like, and now I recognize, right? It's always the generation before is always like, oh, we had it harder, right? And I think, you know, I think there's, it's a mixed bag, because there is definitely some truth about it. Like, let's say in medicine, right? You can't have fixed hours, because illness doesn't have fixed hours, right? And so there's been such interesting studies that have shown actually programs that have more handoffs patient outcomes worsen. Because ultimately, when you're the admitting intern or resident, there's no one in that hospital that knows the patient better than you. And so if at a critical moment, you're just handing that patient off, there's something that's going to be lost. There's no doubt about that. So I do think we need to find this pendulum. Lifestyle and balance are important, but I don't think balance means every position is an 8-to-5. I think different positions have different responsibilities and burdens. So just like in a relationship, on certain things, not everything is 50-50, right? But on the whole, you may see kind of more of that balance. So I think there's a little bit of a, maybe for the current generation of trainees coming in, it's a little bit of a misalignment of where the balance should be, right? I totally get it. Folks shouldn't be doing 100 hours or just doing scut work for no reason, right? Which is unfortunately what sometimes were. People shouldn't be going, you know, 10 days without a break.
100%. That's the proposal.
But at the same time, when you're entering a profession that is dealing with people, even on the developer side, right, there are things that arise all the time. And I think you have to be comfortable to go outside those lines with the caveats that these things aren't, they're not a violation of our own time, right? We have to give something to get something. And I think to excel in anything, you have to give something. I think no one has achieved anything great by just doing the bare minimum. And I think bare minimums were set in place for, honestly, at a very different generational time. You think about the whole 9-to-5 concept, right? Where it came about, folks with blue collar jobs, manual labor, you physically can't work more than 8 or 9 hours, right? We're doing jobs that are mostly thinking and say, hey, oh, it's 8-to-5. Very, very different, right?
Right.
I do worry though, honestly, Tim. Yeah. I mean, I think just about even down the road, as we get older, as loved ones get older, you know, it's hard to find physicians that care, right? To that degree.
Yeah.
You're saying physicians, it could be providers. You don't want just running through your clock or behind the computer writing notes when you have 15 minutes with that person. That does worry me because you're never going to catch up in that way, right? I think we have to work on systematic processes to make, for example, transcribing, those things more digitized or using things like AI.
Right.
But we need to keep the main time the main time, right? I think obviously you're South Florida, but I'm a big basketball guy too. So like love Pat Riley. And the Miami Heat. And one of the mantras always says is keep the main thing, right? And it's like, that's really what it boils down to. Like, you know, you want to be a developer of drugs. You have to keep that as a main thing, knowing that it's not going to fall within those lines. You want to be a great clinician. You have to go outside the lines. But I think, you know, we now already are far more aware of the pitfalls of going over the edge. I think the pendulum has maybe swung a little bit too much
in the
other direction. You know, seeking balance, but I think we lose the hours that are necessary for expertise in some of these disciplines.
Yeah, I do. And I think I do have hope that it is going to swing back to somewhere of a happy medium. Because like you said, I think the new generation is just hyper aware of everything that came before, and maybe they're trying, like you said, to overcompensate, and so it's going that other way. But hopefully in time we'll get back to somewhere in the middle. You know, on that topic, what do you think is for you a personal value that you would not compromise no matter what,
in terms of like a personal element or just a value
in life? A value that you feel like extends into every decision that you make, whether personal, professional, and no matter what the pressure, financial, corporate, you know, what's that grounding thing for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, it's human dignity. I think in every interaction, try to embody that. And I think if there's decisions that sort of compromise that, whether that's short circuiting somebody or not listening or not heeding advice, or even just doing something that devalues the patients that are sacrificing so much. Yeah, that's always a no-go for me. So I try to use that lens. I'm fortunate that was imprinted on me by my parents, which is just like taking care of others, right? And they're caregivers, and they do that maybe even to their own detriment, right? But I think just treating people with respect, and I think that goes so far, because whether it's respecting time, respecting effort, and respecting one's development and past, I think it just allows you to value what different voices are bringing to the table, even in times of friction or conflict.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. What do you feel like is a phase one design pitfall that we have that's still ongoing that you'd love to see changed?
Great question. So first of all, I'd say I love that phase one is becoming the new phase two, right? And I love that we're moving beyond just safety to actually start to actually mandate signal seeking. I think that's so important because the patients that are signing up, I know we read those consent forms that say you will likely not benefit from the therapy, but boy, would I like to give you a therapy that you still have a chance to benefit from. So I think the fact that we're selecting patients more on a biomarker basis, even for phase one studies, the fact that we're looking for efficacy, those are fantastic things. We still, some of this, the old confines, 3+3 designs, right? I mean, it's crazy. We had, actually after leaving academia, we had published a paper with the fellow about looking at the most prevalent phase one designs. And it's still like more than 75% are using 3+3 designs. And you know, it's not that there's anything inherently wrong with 3+3, right? When you have old cytotoxic chemo, I totally get it. You want to be very careful. You want to look at patient by patient decisions. But now when you start to look at things stochastically, right, you have a very promising drug. What if just by chance, your first two patients have a dose limiting toxicity? Just by chance,
right.
You know, are you me that you're going to risk your entire development program just because your dose level one had just unfortunate incidences? You know, the Bayesian designs are a start, but I'd love for us to make much more real-time decisions, you know, based on patients' data that's coming in, reassessing what is the appetite for tolerance of an adverse event profile. And honestly, that is only in the context of what's already in the field. I think if we're dealing with a particularly toxic disease that has limited options, we're willing to tolerate more toxicity, right? I think, you know, 50% grade 3 or greater AEs are okay because now our supportive care measures are better. So we can manage that. So I would love to see the shifting away from 3+3 that's still used because I think one, it slows recruitment. Two, it puts your program at risk sometimes just out of bad luck. And then I'd love as we kind of learn to incorporate more Bayesian designs, but also kind of the power of AI and see how we can harness that. I'd love to see how individual patient toxicity can actually be valued into our decisions about what are thresholds that are safe or unsafe for making escalation or de-escalation decisions.
I like that a lot. Do you feel like you're able to influence that now in your position in terms of like study design that you're working on?
Definitely. We've been able to pivot away from rule-based designs. And especially once we get into more active dose levels, really being able to escalate, de-escalate. So have actually seen that in practice, which is terrific. Because I think
That's
more
really
flexibility
nice.
is better, right?
And that goes to patient-specific treatment, right? So we're talking about personalized medicine from, you know, a biomarker perspective, but also you're talking about it from a toxicity perspective and not letting that toxicity also dictate the dose.
Exactly. And dosing schedules, right? I think one of the things that I love is, like, for example, in our protocols, we have language that says we may adapt to a Q3 weekly dosing or more patient convenience dosing based on things. So we can pivot. We're not just stuck with initially started with the weekly dose that you're stuck with it. So I think that freedom, I'm already seeing it, but I think that really allows optimizing of dose, which is, I think, I've already seen in the last 2 to 3 years, you know, phase one studies are becoming much more focused on being able to dose optimize rather than just saying that on the surface, you know?
Yeah, I like that a lot. I mean, I think that's a huge change and it reflects real practice, right? I think that's been a real sticking point, I would say, across the board in terms of protocols don't actually match what happens in real life, right? You do these very, very structured, perfect eligibility, everything is, and then you go to the real world and then you have this whole new case of side effects and toxicities because you're looking at a real world population that doesn't look like who you enrolled. So this very much mirrors that.
And I think to that point too, magnitude of benefit, I think we all have to recognize, and sometimes as sponsors we're guilty. And I'll say from a good perspective, right? Because I've now at the biotech I was at previously, it was largely preclinical. So I see the amount of effort. We were part of IND studies. I see the amount of work that is under the iceberg, under the water, how much it takes just for a drug to actually reach a phase one study. But with all that said, we can't fall in love with our own assets that we don't look for magnitude of benefit. So I think early killing of drugs that don't show efficacy is such an important thing. And I think that's really where this selection process, and to your point that, listen, sure, in your eligibility criteria, you could allow a more stringent population. We know our patients with PS 0 and 1 are honestly the Olympic athletes of patients relative to real world.
Right.
So if you're not seeing a magnitude there, we shouldn't be kidding ourselves that we're going to see something in the real world. We know the magnitude is probably halved when we go there. So I think these are really important metrics for us when we're making early go, no go decisions, is that, hey, what are the metrics we can really bank on and go forth? And to that point, honestly, one of the things I'd love to see change too is, listen, we need to get rid of ORR. We need to get rid of RECIST. Okay, RECIST is, I mean, you know, listen, I love Charles Martel, but we're still relying on a dinner party of measuring marbles to decide what patients benefit and don't. I think this is super cool that I know there are AI companies that are looking into actually looking at total tumor burden. And actually using that and actually training these algorithms to correlate with time to progression, PFS, and ultimately OS. Because we know that across diseases, response doesn't always correlate with long-term outcomes. And yet, I'm now in a position where when we're thinking about pitching to investors for getting more capital, people, all that they're anchored on is response rate. That doesn't tell the story. So if we are going to rely on tumor measurement, I would love to have a much more smart tumor measurement than RECIST. So I think that definitely has to go. And hopefully in the next few years, we can move beyond that.
Are you involved a lot in AI platforms in your current job? Or personally, is that something that you're interested in? And where do you see it fitting in most in the healthcare space?
Yeah, I mean, I think not directly, but insofar as looking at things like where is it going to fit in? I think there's been a lot of talk in drug development about can AI allow the creation of drugs more efficiently? And I think the answer to that question is still to be determined, right? I think so many of our drugs today come from pre-existing scaffolds, whether that was, for example, from nature or even an existing modality. So for example, radioligand therapy or antibody drug conjugates. We're taking a peptide or an antibody that was already employed for something and then just building upon that. But de novo drug design has not yet been shown to be superior, but with AI. But I think where AI is really going to make a difference is in interpreting data, allowing for some of these earlier go, no goes, and training outcome-based assessment. So I'm really interested to see how, for example, AI companies that can look at signals and see how they correlate with time to event, the meaningful endpoints like OS, how those incorporate. And then also, I think where AI is really going to help the drug development in general is cutting down redundancy and work and streamlining the models of, for example, site activation, data coordination, these types of pieces. So I think AI is definitely going to play a role, but perhaps more in the execution of studies and maybe in how we look at our endpoints. I don't know how much it's actually going to impact de novo drug development, but I would love for that to happen because you think about, let's say, actually taking a study from synthesizing it in the lab all the way through approval, that's a 10% success rate. And that's not even counting the drugs that never make it to becoming a drug.
Right.
I think what I've realized is some of our most potent compounds that could lead to pronounced anti-tumor control or even cure never get out of the lab because of toxicity or unfortunately an untoward effect in an animal model. So I would love to see maybe AI help with that facet too. If we could actually bring some of those compounds that are stuck in lab to patients, that would be amazing. But I guess I'll see it when I believe it on that front.
Yeah.
What's the thing that you're most excited about in terms of drug development? And where do you see, let's say GI cancers, to make it easier, what do you think is the actual next breakthrough in the next 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, you know, we're working on a claudin-directed therapy, an immuno-oncology asset. I think just recognizing that these markers that are prevalent can actually be intervened upon. What excites me most, for example, in the GI arena, there's maybe three stories. So I think one is actually the antibody drug conjugates or radioligand therapy directed toward targets that are overexpressed in certain disease spaces. So I think claudin 18.2 is a super relevant target, not just for gastric and esophageal tumors, but pancreatic, even biliary tract cancer. I think we're really going to see one of these claudin assets make a dent, obviously in gastric gastric cancer. Zolbetuximab has already been approved. We need to get better at making less toxic drugs as well and that have less off-target toxicity. So that's something. I think the RAS story is really emerging. I know it's particularly with the more prevalent kind of the pan-RAS inhibitors, for example, pancreatic cancer, which is a RAS-driven tumor, 90 to 95% are categorized by RAS. I do think we are going to see these newer generation RAS inhibitors make their way, certainly in the later line setting and perhaps even into earlier. I think there are some really interesting different types of immuno-oncology assets that are just beyond PD-1, things that are adenosine-based and so forth, that we're seeing some really interesting things. To make a long answer short, I think biomarker-directed therapy, actually having drugs that can act upon the biomarkers we see, and then maybe some of these truncal mutations, actually having inhibitors will help, and looking at the immune system in a different way. But I think maybe taking a step back in cancer as a whole, what excites me, and I think we haven't really scratched the full potential of this, is I actually think targeted imaging. And that's where I think we can actually draw lessons from, you know, from our disease space, right? I mean, you know, think about it. We talk a lot about precision oncology, but think in a sense how archaic our approach is. We're still relying on repeat biopsies sometimes to see how a cell-based marker is expressed or not expressed. And I think neuroendocrine tumors with somatostatin-based imaging are the path to the future. And obviously now in prostate, we're seeing this with PSMA, but we need real-time imaging, right? So that when patients on one line of therapy, we won't need to get a biopsy because, again, there's so much inherent heterogeneity. One lesion doesn't reflect the magnitude of where a receptor is. So I would love if for each of our targeted approaches, if we had a targeted companion diagnostic, that's, I think, where the future is. Because, you know, I can see a world where every cell surface target has a companion scan where you can actually use that in real time to make decisions on sequencing. So you use a claudin-directed ADC first, and then, you know, you want to do a claudin-directed IO asset. You just get a scan, look at it in real time, how's the expression level, you make your decision right there and go. So that's, I think, what I'm most excited about is I'm starting to see greater investment in targeted imaging. But I also think that in order to get to where we want to get to with some of the breakthroughs, particularly in GI cancer, our imaging investment, and particularly in targeting imaging, needs to be as great almost as the degree that we're spending on drug investments.
And I think that's really thinking about the patient as well, right? What's going to be most feasible and what's the easiest in terms of that?
But yeah, I mean, I think that's why it's so interesting that rare tumor type like neuroendocrine has really set such a precedent, right? You know, honestly speaking, too, just looking at the field as a whole, right now, antibody drug conjugates are the rage, and rightfully so. But I think that's smart bomb chemotherapy. But radioligand therapy is just scratching the surface. So I think the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see an explosion of the same targets that these ADCs are going after. Mm-hmm. You're going to start to see RLT. And I think that's going to be really amazing.
Yeah. I think if anybody listening to this at any point takes one thing that you said, though, in terms of response, I 100% agree with you that response rate cannot be our target. That longevity of response has to be the focus. And it's very short-sighted to just look at, okay, is it shrinking the cancer right now? And you bring up neuroendocrine tumors, and we're seeing that right now, I think, with the evolution of RLT in terms of alpha, beta emitters and all of that. And I know alpha is like this hot thing, and every patient wants it and everybody wants it. But when you really look at the longevity of response, at one, I don't think we know that yet.
Yeah,
and two, that toxicity profile in the short term, there is a difference. And so I think we have to weigh all of that very carefully before we run to just changing the status quo across the board.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think you bring up such a fascinating point about sequencing, too. I think it's always that the next hottest therapy, folks now want to position that first. And I think that's fine, right? I think if there's truly a breakthrough drug, absolutely. But you have to do the tests. You have to actually do the trials and prove it. Because as he says, it's just a sequencing thing, right? Is it beta followed by alpha actually leads to a longer OS rather than starting with alpha and then progressing on that? We don't know, right? And we have to do those elements because, as you said, maybe the bone marrow toxicity is more, right? Maybe there's more myelodysplasia, right? And is the juice worth the squeeze? I think something that we continually have to ask. And then also the patients that you enroll, right? I mean, you know, I think with some of the NETTER 2 data. Really interesting response rates. But of course, the more aggressive tumors you enroll, the more response you're going to get. But duration is sort of the key. So I think I would love to move beyond ORR. And hopefully we as a field can do that. Because, you know, despite everything and all of these things, and certainly we're not the first people to raise this issue, it's still ultimately the flag that's planted in the ground, right? So what's the ORR? That's oftentimes the first question that's asked.
Right. Okay, rapid fire.
Okay.
Go to coffee shop order.
Ooh, I'm simple. I'm just like an Americano.
Okay.
Black. Maybe grab a yogurt parfait as well.
Okay. All right. A hidden talent nobody on your team at least knows about.
So with the spoken word, I used to do a little rap as well. So yeah, ghost rapper in my mind, at least.
Okay. All right. Is any of this documented and online? Can people find it?
maybe potentially. Yeah. There's maybe a few wedding performances here and there. So.
Oh my. Okay. All right. We got some stalking to do. One app on your phone that
I'll
you can't
you
live without.
If you're interested.
Please. Yes.
Okay. One app. Man, Uber Eats is amazing. I will say Uber amazing, because no matter where you go, what time you get in the day, it's nice to get good food.
Okay.
That's potentially accessible, particularly at conferences, you know, where
we
know that conference
true.
Food is not the best stuff.
No, not it. Okay, your favorite movie?
All time, Godfather, one and two. I put them together. Of late, Sinners. You got to go watch it if you haven't watched it.
I did not see it. Okay.
You got to watch it.
Okay.
Amazing. It's a love letter to blues, a little bit of a vampire story, but really it's about music.
Okay. Okay. I love that. Favorite conference location that's ever taken you?
Ooh, that's a great one. Barcelona is one of my favorite cities.
Yeah.
Enet back in the day was there, and sometimes Esmosgi is there as well. So.
Okay. Your go-to song on repeat this week?
Oh man, that's a good one. Probably it's a jazz hip hop song called Naomi by Lupe Fiasco. So it's a good vibe to it.
Okay, I'm gonna put that on the card for this.
All right.
And last one, adjective that you think your friends would use to describe you.
Oh man, I don't want to go there. odd, I guess. I can't put in a box.
Odd. Okay.
Surprising, maybe.
I'm gathering that. I'm definitely gathering that. Okay. Anything that we haven't talked about that you would like to leave people with?
No, this is amazing. I'm so glad that you're like doing this, and I hope you keep this up, because it's so cool to talk about. We were just talking the other day that there are like-minded folks that think in cross-disciplinary ways. And I think it's amazing to just get these conversations. We need to have more conversations with people that are curious and really kind of, you know, not to make any big picture statements, but there's a lot of content creation these days and not a lot of discretion always. So it's great to have full content out there too. And I love that you're doing this. So
thank you.
Thank you so much.
I really appreciate your time. And this has been an awesome conversation. I can't wait to put this out there.
Love that.
Thank you so much.
Good to see you. Congratulations.
So good to see you.
Thank you. So happy for you.
Thank you.
Awesome.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.